Megan Nosel, and thank you for listening to this episode of the SLP Minded Podcast, the show that brings the research to the clinic. Are you SLP minded? Not sure? Do you label yourself as an SLP geek? Do you enjoy critically thinking about the research in our field? Do you have dreams of pursuing a doctorate or conducting your own research study one day? Do you enjoy talking with the researchers, seeking their insight, and hearing about their discoveries? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then the SLP Minded Podcast is definitely for you. The aims of this podcast are to encourage a stronger appreciation for research and to foster a stronger relationship between the researchers and the clinicians. By interviewing medical SLP researchers about their latest studies, discoveries, and the clinical implications of their work, we can definitely think more critically about the ways to improve our own evidence-based practices and patient outcomes. Don't forget to download this episode's references and resources page on the website for more information. Sounds easy enough, right? Sure. Sit back and enjoy this insightful conversation. Today, I'm talking with Dr. Deborah Hirsch about a case study she wrote about in Aphasiology in March of 2018. If you're interested in reading the full article, it's available on the podcast website at www.slpminded.com/episodes. Dr. Hirsch is an associate professor in speech pathology at Edith Cowan University in Perth, Western Australia. She is a fellow of Speech Pathology Australia. She has nearly 30 years of clinical research and teaching experience in speech pathology in the UK and Australia. She's published and presented extensively in the areas of discharge from aphasia therapy, professional client relationships, aphasia groups, rehabilitation goal setting, aphasia assessment and acquired communication disorder in Aboriginal Australians following stroke and brain injury. I am really happy to talk with you today. Motivational interviewing is one of those things that interests me just from a counseling perspective, from what we do. And I was hoping that we would be able to do more with motivational interviewing. And so when I saw your study, I was really interested. So I'm so thankful that you can do this with me.
No worries. A pleasure. A pleasure.
So could you please describe motivational interviewing for listeners who really aren't familiar with this approach?
Sure. So motivational interviewing is actually a counseling approach. It was developed really originally in the area of addiction. So it was originally used, the two key names in the area are Miller and Rolnick, and the process of motivational interviewing was originally developed for people who needed assistance through counselling to deal with things like lifestyle issues, particularly alcohol, people who were alcohol addicted, who may have been drug addicted, people who perhaps have needed a little bit of sort of help, particularly around addiction issues, gambling, for example. So I've had a look at some of the work of Miller and Rolnick, and they do have now quite a strong evidence base. And they found that motivational interviewing as a particular approach had quite positive effects in terms of changing people's behaviours. And so it's since sort of broadened out to a whole range of areas, including health. So we've moved away from the focus on addiction, and it's now being used within healthcare and increasingly in allied healthcare, which is very interesting. So there is actually a very large literature on motivational interviewing, but not all relevant to speech pathology. As I say, a lot of it is around lifestyle issues in other areas. The essence of it, it uses some sort of standard things that you see in counselling, particularly open questions, empathetic listening, using reflection and summarizing when you listen to people. So counseling techniques often suggest that the counselor will listen carefully, listen actively, and then reflect back what the person has told them in a way, perhaps paraphrase it slightly, reflect back so that that person can hear, if you like, how they've been received, and then reconsider what they've said you know, reflected back to them. So these kinds of techniques do come into motivational interviewing as well, just as they would do in any other counselling technique. I think what's really interesting about this approach, though, is that it does something slightly different. There's a notion in MI, or motivational interviewing, I'll call it MI, called resisting the writing reflex, which is the desire of a counsellor or a listener to start suggesting what somebody should do, right? So motivational interviewing specifically says not to do that, resist doing that, because although we're all trying to help somebody, if we start saying, well, that's interesting, I think you should do this, often that doesn't help somebody who's in a state of what they call ambivalence. And by ambivalence, what I mean there is someone who, let's say, for example, we take a classic thing about obesity and exercise. So somebody might say, oh, I know I should go to the gym. I know I don't get off the couch. I know that's what I should be doing, but I just don't think it's the right time. You know, I'm busy and there's other things going on in my life. It's just too hard. That would be an example of ambivalence. Somebody wants to do something, but then they don't do it. Okay.
Right.
And we all experience, you know, that. And what they're saying is that if you go to that person and say, well, I really think you should start going to the gym 3 times a week, what then happens is that people who are in a state of ambivalence will often then defend the other side. And they'll say things like, well, you may be right, but I can't possibly do that now because I'm much too busy or whatever. So if you sometimes with a person who's in that state, you push one side, they then push harder back. They push from the other side. Now, what motivational interviewing does is recognize that phenomenon. And it says, rather than doing that, why don't you listen to that person and offer them, if you like, a chance to reflect on what they're saying and in a sense come up with their own solution to it. And you do that through careful counselling so that they then talk themselves into making the change, which is far more effective in terms of actually allowing that change to take hold in someone's mind. And that is what's called encouraging change talk, or the language of change. So by reflecting back what they're saying and using a range of techniques which we can talk about in motivational interviewing, it's about allowing someone to, if you like, empowering them to recognize a path that they actually want and allowing them to resolve that ambivalence. Does that
you explain MI so well? Wow. That is probably one of the best summaries of MI I've ever heard.
Well, that's lovely.
Wow, that is really great. That's a great summary. How did you become interested in MI?
Okay, so I'm not a psychotherapist or a counselor. I'm a speech pathologist. So my PhD, for anyone in the aphasiology area, you might know the stuff, but my PhD was looking at the experiences of people being discharged from therapy. And one of the findings in that study that I did was that speech pathologists who are treating people with aphasia, if they believe that they're not motivated to do therapy, they are more likely to discharge them from therapy. And so I was interested in notions of how we judge motivation in other people. I was quite interested in how therapists judge whether they think somebody is motivated to do therapy or not. You know, what is it that they look for? Bearing in mind people with aphasia have just had a stroke and are not happy. And, you know, there are lots and lots of things that they're thinking about. How is it that a therapist judges whether they are enthusiastic for therapy, whether they're, a good rehabilitation candidate, you know, all this talk that we do. And so I was quite interested in that idea of motivation for something. But that was part of that sort of whole study.
Well, what did you find? I'd like to know.
Well, it's interesting within the dish. Sorry, this is slightly off motivational interviewing itself as a topic, but
not really. I mean, it's really connected. I would like to. I mean, that goes through my mind often. I think all these factors we have to consider. Someone's just had a major life change, and I don't know if anyone would be quite motivated to do some hard work at that point.
But that is exactly what we expect them to do.
That's true.
I mean, you would have heard, therapists talking to each other in the coffee room or, in the staff room, and they'll say things like, God, so-and-so didn't turn up again today. Or, he always looks so miserable. I suggest something and he's just not enthusiastic and I just don't think it's the right time. Maybe we should discharge him. Those kinds of things are not unusual.
I agree.
I've got a paper which is more specifically about how people judge motivation, some stuff around the topic. But I think essentially the finding is that patients who are, in quotes, good patients are offered more therapy than those who are not. And it doesn't take into account the massive changes that people post-stroke have to deal with. And I think it can be it can result in a loss of access to opportunity for those who are finding it difficult. So it is something that we do need to consider about how you look at somebody, how you make a judgment about how rehabable they are at that particular time. And it can be quite subtle. And, it may be then that an approach, a counselling, more of a counselling approach with people, and I would add for this in relation to people with aphasia, that's all through supported conversation, but we have the skills as a profession to do that, that we need a bit more time with people sometimes to help them deal with this massive change. And that's tricky because, of course, there are boundaries between what a speech pathologist does and what a psychologist does. But psychologists or counsellors are not trained in supported conversation. And so it may be that those boundaries are very slightly blurred. Obviously, we are talking about counselling around communication. And I would strongly then refer also people to Audrey Holland's wonderful book on counselling and communication disorders. So that's the best place to start. But it is that issue about what our role is in that early period around helping people come to terms with stuff and then take advantage of the therapy that we can offer.
Did you receive some training in MI?
No. So I haven't been trained in MI. And in relation to this case, I didn't do MI with this lady. So do you want the story of the case that we discussed?
Yes, please.
Okay. So the story behind this is that I happened through a chance meeting. I had gone to deliver a talk at a rehabilitation unit. And through a chance meeting, I met a delightful woman who was doing her PhD. This is Rosemary Newitt, who is a co-author with me on the aphasiology published and the short paper that you've picked up on. So Rosemary was doing her PhD, and her training is as an exercise physiologist. And she was doing a study looking at something called the Adapted Physical Activity Program, which is developed through her and her supervisors at James Cook University in Queensland in Australia. And her PhD involved offering an opportunity to do some more physical activity with people post-stroke, sometimes in the chronic phase, long-time post-stroke, and to help people be more physically active. And she was looking at evaluating that for her study. And just by chance, one of the people on her cohort was this lady. And she had had a stroke 6 years earlier. She had a mass of medical issues. They're listed, some of them are listed in the paper, including schizophrenia. So she was a complex lady. And she had quite significant expressive aphasia and pretty sort of moderate level, receptive. She was quite severely aphasic. And Rose had her put forward as a candidate for her study, and she'd consented to be in the study. But when Rose came to actually work out how she was going to do this program, the APAP program. She couldn't kind of work it out. And she was considering, because this had a motivational interviewing component as part of the APAP, and she has been MI trained. I haven't, but she has. She was considering dropping her from the study. And she came to see me. Again, it's an access issue. This recording isn't just about motivational interviewing. From my perspective, it's about access to services and access to opportunities for people with aphasia. So, yeah, so she came to see me at that talk and chatted to me, and she just asked me my advice about whether this lady could be suitable, as somebody with severe aphasia, could be suitable for motivational interviewing. So I went back and had a look at what Change Talk was all about. And then I had a session, quite a long session with Rose, where we talked. I hadn't met this lady, and we talked through what kinds of things you can do with supported conversation. And we worked out that there might be some things that Rose could try. So to give you an example, one of the things that Rose was suggesting that they use is something called values cards sorting, which is where you have cards which have things that are written on them or pictured on them that are important, you know, and you can rate them. So there might be family, it might be work, it might be more time doing physical activity, more time reading, whatever, the values that people have, and not just activities, but a whole range of things. So we talked about picturing values cards, you know, with options of things that one can have in life, like a goal setting type program, you know, a bit like you would if you had lots of goals pictured for a person in a goal setting process.
Are these the live cards?
It's similar to that. They're actually not specifically the live cards, but very similar idea.
Okay.
And so we talked about what she does once she, because this lady was able to understand the notion of value sorts, and they did that. And then what you might do with those concepts afterwards. So I talked to her about visual timelines. We talked about ratings, you know, how visually making a visual rating. We talked about visualizing her week. So, for example, the APAP was offered, I think, 3 times a week as an exercise program for 15 weeks. And it was too difficult to discuss that without it being visualized. So we talked about how you would set out in a way that this lady was able to understand, you know, how you could put the gym sessions in or out of the week and what other things she might do and so on. So it was all about personalizing the options and giving her an opportunity to choose. And all of these are, you know, supported conversation type ideas. It's all about, you know, finding an alternative channel, finding some way to make something accessible. So that's what we did. And then over time, as she kept her in the program, and over time we had many telephone conversations talking about tweaking that. And one of the, again, for just to illustrate this lady, one of the issues that came up was that she was actually quite lonely. She was dependent on carers and on family. And one of the ways that Rose was able to make the gym session, which, as I say, she was quite ambivalent about at the start, how to make exercise more appealing was, we discussed this, was to link it with something that she did want on her value sort card, you know, sorting. And one of those was to go out and meet people who, you know, would be nice to her, some kind of social connection. And so Rose organized for the people in the gym to actively greet her when she came each time and to walk up to her and say, hello, how are you? It's lovely to see you here today. And normally the bicycles were facing the wall in the gym and they organized to turn them around so that she would be facing into the gym and could be seeing people and they would wave at her. And there was an attempt then very much geared to her wishes and her desires, and it was all set up so that her motivation to go would be increased because it was being linked to something that she had valued and that she was finding important. So those kinds of quite subtle things helped to engage her. And it was about not saying to her, you must go to the gym 3 times a week, but it was asking her, what's important to you? What do you want to do? What could make this better? How could it be something, you know, in motivational interviewing, one of the techniques they have is an idea of, for example, rating people's confidence with doing something, or rating, you know, what would help them to do something. So the importance of something for them. You know, how important is it for you to be going to the gym? Can you tell me, say from 1 to 10, how would you rate that? You know, well, it's a 5 or it's a 7 or whatever. And then in motivational interviewing, they'll say, okay, well, that's interesting. What would make it an 8? You know, what would it look like if it was a 9? So you can do that with the importance of something. You get the person to come up with their own ideas about it. And then you can look at the confidence that they have in making that change. So, okay, you're on a 6. You know, what would make that a 9? Or what would make that a 7? Or whatever. So for her, those rating scales were visualized. And the social thing allowed it to go up. You know, oh, that's nice. Well, you know, whatever. So those are the kinds of things that we looked at. And so the story of this lady was, as I say, I didn't meet her. The therapy was carried out by the exercise physiologist as part of this PhD. What fascinated me about this process was not about me doing it as a speech therapist or speech pathologist working with somebody with MI. I was interested in the potential for us to work with other people who do MI, not related to communication necessarily, but just related to life, you know, being well after a stroke, how to stay healthy, how to exercise, to eat right, not to drink too much. And I think we have potential to work with other people, with psychologists, with physios, all sorts of different people, because we can then say, yes, you can include people with aphasia because this is the way that we can help you to do it. So the article in Aphasiology is about an interprofessional approach. So that was the first thing. And the other thing, I know this answers one of the other questions that you were interested around, you know, what's the evidence that people with aphasia are being excluded from these studies? Well, there are a number of studies which I kind of found. So basically I did a search, you know, to see who's used motivational interviewing after stroke or whatever. There's one study in Stroke, the journal Stroke. It's a 2015 study by Barker, Collo and colleagues. I can send this to you later, Megan. And that is working with stroke, people who've had strokes, and it's about secondary stroke prevention strategies. But they exclude people with aphasia because they're seen as too difficult to use change talk, too difficult to engage in the counselling process.
I can believe this.
There's another study also with Barker Collo, but as third author by an author, Krishnamurthy. That one's published in the International Journal of Stroke. I think the same thing comes up. And then there's another paper by Watkins and colleagues looking at motivational interviewing in the acute, you know, early, an RCT, and that's published in Stroke. And I think also they're excluded there. So that there is some evidence that that motivational interviewing is now seen as a counselling approach which is useful for certain things after stroke, but is seen as too difficult to, you know, to use with people with aphasia. And what I think is interesting there is that the assumptions are that the only services that we need to worry about are about speech language pathology and communication. But why is it that someone with aphasia, and they're often, you know, they're quite severe strokes with people with aphasia, they're often quite sort of devastating and suggest big problems. Why is it that secondary stroke prevention strategies or, you know, things like, you know, a whole range of things, lifestyle things. It's not as if having got aphasia, you didn't have a history of alcoholism or you weren't overweight or, you know, all of these lifestyle issues apply just as much to them as they do to any other person who's had a stroke. And yet those strategies to try and address those other lifestyle issues for people are not being, as far as I could see from those studies anyway, were not being offered to people with aphasia. And I thought that was quite interesting.
See, that's why I find it so valuable to talk to the researcher, because I read the study and I didn't think about that, actually. You know, I really didn't see that side of it, and that is a completely valid point, and I think that's really fascinating. I think it could be easily missed.
Okay.
Maybe I was not reading it. Maybe I was not having a good reading day, but
well, maybe I didn't write it clearly enough.
Well, you know, it being short,
yes.
You know, you only have so much, you know, space to write. And, I find that really interesting. That's a wonderful point. And why does it just have to be about speech and language? It doesn't have to be. I mean, we should be able to work with other professionals to help people with aphasia reach any goal.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The publication in Aphasiology was a long but still a published abstract. It was the work was presented. I presented it at a conference, the International Aphasia Rehabilitation Conference, as a poster. So this was writing up, you know, for a published abstract. The number of words were restricted, but the issues I think that this case raises are very broad. I agree with you. I think our focus is very narrow.
I thought you were making the point that if we can do this with an exercise program, we could do this with other things as well. But probably more related to speech and language, I was thinking.
Yeah, I think what I wanted to do was show two things. First of all, motivational interviewing is an approach now that's being used across allied health. If we're going to make that accessible for people with aphasia, we can work interprofessionally, we can work with colleagues effectively to make those things accessible to them. That was the first point. The other thing is, I think about the severity of the aphasia. Now, I was interested in the fact that we did this with a lady whose medical history, I mean, see if I can find the list. I haven't got it in front of me.
You know, she had a baseline history of mental illness, she had epilepsy, she had neuromuscular, skeletal conditions, a lot going on. And that was one of my questions. How and why did you select this patient? It seemed like the hardest patient you could select, which is really good in that. Yes. But, I mean, if you were able to do with the most severe and the most complex, what could you do with moderate and what could you do with mild? Wow.
Well, that's right. I mean, this, you know, and as I say, the complexity, it was actually the complexity of her aphasia that was going to almost get her chucked off the APAP program, you know. But one of the things that you could argue is that somebody like that who is basically sedentary after their stroke, and she was in a wheelchair, she's exactly the person who needs some very careful professional support to increase her physical activity in order to prevent, you know, if it's done properly, in order to prevent another stroke or in order to give her more quality of life and in order to counter further decline. You know, it's almost like people are, you know, the too hard basket, they're put there. And so, of course, things don't get better. So I didn't choose her.
Right.
She was just there.
Yeah, she was just there.
She was just there. And it was my colleague Rose who, you know, said, can we keep this lady in my study? And well, Yes, probably.
So I'm curious about the interaction between you and the exercise physiologist. Like you said, you never met this patient.
No. No.
So you were pretty much training Rose?
So I went over, as I say, to give a talk at a rehab center, and that's where I met her. And we chatted for quite some time face to face when I was there, and we talked about, you know, the concepts behind her study and this particular case, this lady, all de-identified at that point, absolutely, and she is in the paper. And whether or not, in theory, there were strategies that could allow her to be retained in the program. And, I mean, you know, I think this lady had sufficient comprehension to manage value sort cards and these other things, so why not? You know, if you can use supported conversation, that's precisely the kind of person you want to be working with. And it's not like the suggestions that we have with SCA are particularly difficult. You know, we're actually just making sense of notions of different channels of communication and how you can support comprehension and how you can support somebody's ability to indicate a choice. And that's not complex. You know, there's no reason why we shouldn't be sharing those strategies with other health professionals in order to make things like this accessible.
How did you know to start with, like, a values card?
Oh, she'd already done a version of that with people as part of the APAP program. So it was
okay.
Simply a matter of making, because a lot of MI is about, you know, understanding what people want, actually hearing their side of the story. And I think value sort cards are commonly used. What I was able to talk about, but less visual. So we talked about visualizing that and making them pictorial necessarily rather than only written.
Okay.
But the things like the rating scales, often that is done often verbally.
Right.
So in MI, you'll often say, now, if you imagine a scale of 1 to 10 and, you know, your feelings about going off to the gym, where would you put them? You know, it's often done verbally. So we talked about how to visualize it. Another example, Rose hadn't thought at that point to enlist this lady's carers and family to use personalized photos. And that worked very well. So in terms of goal setting and activities through the week and so on, those ideas, we discussed ideas of actually photographing the lady on a modified bike, a motormed, you know, so you can cycle from your wheelchair. So to have a photo of her doing that, to be able to say, look what you did today, you know, look at you, you're doing this, and stick it up on her wall next to her bed, or put it on a poster somewhere, or part of her book of how she's, you know, managing, like a portfolio type book. So things like that, which are very visual, they're personalized, that was really helpful. We, as I say, we talked about the ideas of linking her social goals with gym, of her feeling celebrating achievements for people. Actually, all these things tie in with motivation, but they're very concrete and they're very real for people. So those kinds of things were important. Yeah.
How did you illustrate, like, most important to me?
With the values thing, that those cards are rated. So you might have a range of things that you want to, you know, to do. Now, Rose actually did that with her, so I can't tell you exactly where she put what card. But you can have a scale, like a ladder, and you can say right at the top, you know, somebody with quite significant aphasia will still understand this, you know. At the top, this is the best. This is number one. This is the most important. What would you put there?
Okay.
And then the next one and the next one, and you can keep it on the table so they can see where they're at, you know, and all those things are possible. What's also interesting around this is that motivational interviewing as a concept recognizes the real importance of developing a relationship, a trusting relationship between the counselor and the person. You do that over time, and you do that by, you know, developing that relationship, getting to know what is important for that person. And I think over time, Rose was able to do that with her, and all of that helps. You know, all of that helps. So, you know, you're seeing that person in a context. You're giving them an opportunity to get to know you, and for you to get to know them and what's important. And as I say, also talking to the carers and her family, because those kinds of contacts help you to understand the motivations. Again, for somebody who's quite dependent, she wasn't living alone. She was living with her sister, and those kinds of things also help with building that relationship and actually working out, you know, what it is that the person might feel like doing, you know, what it is that they can talk themselves into doing. As I say, it's not about saying you should do this. It's not a quick fix. It's about helping people talk themselves into, you know, listening for their change talk. And what's, again, another point that's also interesting is, of course, in motivational interviewing, it's about listening for change talk in talk. But here we might be listening out for signs of somebody's willingness to change through a different medium. You know, if they can't tell you in words, well, last week I thought, nah, couldn't possibly go to the gym. And this week, funnily enough, well, maybe I'll try it. You know, it would have to come through some other kind of rating, and it might be pointing to a point on a scale. It might be that you can again reflect back. I think you look a bit happier today. You know, are you feeling, how are you feeling about this idea that we're talking about? Anyone who works with someone with aphasia will see that, you know, you can see how people are feeling. They just may not express it through classic talk. And I think this is where other professionals assume that they cannot participate in an interview, but actually you can get lots of information from people even if their expressive language is impaired.
So do you think Rose felt like that this gave her confidence that she could replicate this with someone who has aphasia?
Bearing in mind everybody that you meet with aphasia is different. So, but I think this gave her an insight into supported conversation. I sent her Aura Kagan's key papers on it. You know, there's lots of lovely stuff on YouTube about people using SCA. And I think she could see that making, you know, giving somebody the option to point to a choice, actually, you know, having this Ladies Week on a big poster stuck up on her bed, above her bed, you know, all of those things make it accessible. It's interesting. It's really about accessibility and communication accessibility. I mean, I think what was lovely about working with this particular exercise physiologist was that she was really happy to give it a go, and she did. You know, she was very pleased. And as I say in the paper, this lady went through the 15 weeks of the program, having previously, for the 6 years post-stroke, been pretty much inactive. So something must have worked. She hadn't done any physical exercise. And through, you know, just putting together all those links, making it friendly, giving her a sense that she's achieved something, allowing her to choose what she did, when she went. She got to choose. It was her choice to go when she went, how often she would go and what she would do when she got there. So, you know, what exercise. So you can photograph all the different pieces of equipment in your initial study, even if you're not, you know, discussions, or even if you're not actually in the gym to point to it, you could say, well, this one, you can start slowly. How would you like to just do it for 5 minutes? Would you like to do it for 10 minutes? You start giving people choices. Motivational interviewing is about autonomy, giving people a sense that they can choose their own, they can decide, they can resolve their own ambivalence, they can choose their own path, rather than saying, right, we're going to do 10 minutes of this, and then you're going to do this, and then you're going to do this.
Well, and that really aligns with life participation approach.
Absolutely. They're, all these things overlap.
Yeah.
I think we know, as a profession, we know what works. It's a question of applying it.
Right.
And actually allowing our colleagues to see some of that. And I don't think we share this knowledge, particularly outside our field, always. But as I said, that the point of this article wasn't about me doing it necessarily. It was trying to expose that it can be done, and trying to expose that we can do this with the professionals who are offering those programs which use motivational interviewing, and that this is about a lifestyle issue for people with aphasia that they have just as much right to be involved with as any other person who might be offered some kind of intervention.
I hope you do more of this work, because it's really needed.
I agree. I think after having something like aphasia, people may well be put into a box.
Another reason why I really wanted to talk with you is because I don't often read single case studies.
Mm.
And I wondered, you know, perhaps I will now, because I really liked yours. Did you ever consider doing a larger study? Could you tell me more about just the value behind single case studies in our profession?
I'm interested in single case studies, and by this I don't mean there are single case studies and single case studies. So you can have the classic single case study designs,
right,
like ABABAB, whatever designs. So those are quantitative. They're usually looking at an efficacy study, something that's looking to see if an intervention works. They are very important. You know, in particularly, I mean, in the phasiology, the single case is the nuts and bolts of cognitive neuropsychology, for example, which has many, many single case studies to try and illustrate very detailed, in-depth changes that can happen for one patient where you put your efforts into a very particular, carefully tailored intervention for that person. This isn't the kind of case study I'm talking about here. This was very descriptive, and it was simply to illustrate, I thought, quite important lessons to be learned from the work with this particular lady, and that's what the paper is about. It's not suggesting that any of this can be generalized at a detailed level. It's looking at conceptual generalization. It's saying this case shows that you can work with MI as a speech pathologist with other colleagues, even with people with more severe aphasia. And those notions are important and can be illustrated with this case. That's the level that it's at. And actually, what's interesting is, you know, historically in medical circles, you know, if you think about the way Oliver Sacks talks about patient stories, you know, or something like that, you can use a discussion about a particular patient, the man who mistook his wife for a hat, for example, and that is a single story, and it tells you something interesting. It's not a scientific empirical study per se, but it has its use. So I've used single cases for things like that. And in the work, some of the work and some of the research I've done, I've been quite interested in the power of narrative and of story. And so a single case study is a great way to look in depth at somebody's story or somebody's perspective, a very particular, if you like, precedent or learning on a particular topic. And single case studies do that very, very well, qualitative single case studies. So they're different from the quantitative, the empirical single case design that many people would initially think of in terms of, you know, classic single case designs. I suppose effectively we're using a case study like you would in a problem-based learning approach or whatever, but using a single case study here to tell a story about a particular circumstance. And I think in the case of this particular lady, it was a valuable story. It's very new. I was struck by the fact, actually, looking at the literature, that how little motivational interviewing has been used or mentioned even in aphasiology. So just recently, it is mentioned in a chapter the book by Coppens and Patterson, which is called Aphasia Rehabilitation Clinical Challenges. There's a chapter in there which talks about motivation, self-determination theory, and things like that. So that there is just now a few mentions within aphasiology, but very little. I think this is probably the paper that I put out is pretty much the first time I've seen something specifically looking at applying motivational interviewing in that sense, although, as I say, they do discuss it as a potential approach for people with aphasia. So it's starting to happen, but very, very slowly. And this is a very, you know, an early example in our field of the use of this approach.
I think I'll have to read more case studies because I really liked the story, and I can see the value in both quantitative and qualitative, of course.
Yes. It is really telling a story. I mean, you know, and I think that, you know, there's lovely movement now in within the medical field talking about something called narrative-based medicine, which I'm quite interested in. Again, it's an approach that says that the ability for doctors or for other health professionals to listen to their patients more, to listen to their stories, to actually understand their perspectives is a narrative approach. And you learn to do medicine differently, or in our case, we could perhaps do speech pathology differently if we are allowed the time to genuinely listen to what people want. And motivational interviewing as an approach is about that. It's about respecting people's autonomy. It's about active listening, and it's about allowing people the space through this counselling technique to evoke the word they use. They talk about evoking, but evoke their own change talk, evoke their own ability to work out their own solutions.
What advice could you give to people who might be thinking about writing a case study for the first time? You know, writing in a journal is so overwhelming. All the restrictions and the requirements, and I wondered if you had any advice for someone who's thinking about, you know, I have a really good story to tell people, and I'm not sure where to start, or any lessons or insight you could give us.
There is an author called, his surname is Yin, Y-I-N. I can't remember. I think it's Robert Yin. Can't remember. His textbook is about single case studies, and there's some stuff in there about writing up a qualitative single case. He talks about single case design. I think what's important, if you are actually going to try and publish a single case, because it has clinical significance, and I haven't necessarily done this very well with mine, because she wasn't my patient. I'm really telling a story about the concept of using MI with people with aphasia. But generally, if you are doing single case work, you actually need to have a rigorous line of evidence for that case. So if you were going to present, it depends if it's, you know, it's a big question, because it could represent many different kinds of research questions. But you want to have as much information and detail about that case as possible. You want to have a very clear sense of why you're telling, why you think that story is worth telling. And to be able to explain and justify to your reader why that is important. What does it tell you that's slightly different or reinforces an important message or whatever? I think you would need to check which journal you go for. Some journals really do not like publishing research where there's only one patient there, and that's because they may not be thinking with a qualitative hat on. But qualitative research is about, well, it's about many things, but it can really help to understand the notion of somebody's experience, perceptions. You know, qualitative work is often about understanding the human experience of something. There are, I mean, okay, a lovely place to start would be Jackie Hinckley's work on narrative-based approaches in speech-language pathology. And she tells stories in that book. So in a sense, she's telling her, at one point she tells her own story. She says, what we publish about practice is not just the perceptions of our patients or what they tell us. It's also about our own working practices and our own stories as speech pathologists and, you know, what we can share. So, okay, so perhaps Robert Ian's work, Jackie Hinckley's work, some lovely work by Nina Simmons-Mackie looking at what happens between one therapist and one patient using conversational analysis, for example. There are many different ways of telling these stories, but they're still focusing on small numbers of participants in a study, or looking at, you know, small micro level stories. That's really what this is an example of. It's not generalizable to a population per se. It's about narrowing down to a micro view of something. And I think that has value. If we only look at group scores and aggregated data, we lose the individual. And this paper is just a little snapshot of what happened for one individual. And I think that that's still valuable. We still have a role in sharing that. Yeah.
Sure. Thank you. That was good advice. You pointed out a really important lesson for all of us. whether we're SLPs or not, we cannot exclude people just because they have aphasia.
That's right. Yeah.
And you proved it. So... Go SLPs!
Yes, go SLPs. Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk to you. It's been absolutely delightful, so thank you.
The lively theme music for the SLP Minded podcast was written by my fellow SLP and good friend, Justin Berry. Thank you so much for providing us your musical talent and creativity, Justin. You rock. And thanks, everyone, for listening to today's show.